I'm indebted to Henry Miller for the title of this book, which I derive from a phrase of his in Into the Nightlife. It's used out of context, but expresses the way I feel about these poems. Each poem should be its own Coney Island of the mind, its own circus of the soul. Number one, constantly risking absurdity and death whenever he performs above the heads of his audience. The poet, like an acrobat, climbs on rhyme to a high wire of his own making, and balancing on I-beams above a sea of faces, paces his way to the other side of day, performing entrechats and sleight-of-foot tricks and other high theatrics, and all without mistaking anything for what it may not be. For he's the super-realist who must perforce perceive taut truth before the taking of each stance or step in his supposed advance toward that still higher perch where beauty stands and waits with gravity to start her death-defying leap. And he, a little Charlie Chaplin man, who may or may not catch her fair eternal form spread-eagled in the empty air of existence. Number two, the wounded wilderness of Morris Graves is not the same wild west the white man found. It is a land that Buddha came upon from a different direction. It is a wild white nest in the true mad north of introspection, where falcons of the inner eye dive and die, glimpsing in their dying fall a whole rapt memory of existence, and with grave chalk wing draw upon the leaded sky a thousand threaded images of flight. It is the night that is their native habitat, these spirit birds with dread white wings, these droves of plover, bearded eagles, blind birds singing in glass fields, these moon-mad swans and ecstatic ganders, trapped egrets, charcoal owls, trotting turtle symbols, these pink fish among mountains, shrikes seeking to nest, blue birds in brown chambers, white-boned birds mating in air, masked birds fishing in golden streams, and an ibis feeding on its own breast, and a carved crow with seeds, and a ceremonial bronze taking the form of a fisher, and a stray Connemara puka, life-size, and then those blown mute birds bearing fish and paper messages between two streams, which are the twin streams of oblivion, wherein the imagination turning upon itself with white electric vision refines itself still mad and unfed among the Hebrides. Number three, sailing through the Straits of Deimos, we saw symbolic birds shrieking over us, while eager eagles hovered and elephants in bathtubs floated past us out to sea, strumming bent mandolins and bailing for old glory with their ears, while patriotic maidens wearing paper poppies and eating bonbons ran along the shores wailing after us, and while we lashed ourselves to masts and stopped our ears with chewing gum, dying donkeys on high hills sang low songs, and gay cows flew away, chanting Athenian anthems as their pods turned to tulips. And heliocopters from Helios flew over us, dropping free railway tickets from Los Angeles to heaven and promising free elections, so that we set up mast and sail on that swart ship once more, and so set forth once more, forth upon the gobbly sea, loaded with liberated vestal virgins and discus throwers, reading Walden. But shortly after reaching the strange suburban shores of that great American demi-democracy, looked at each other with a mild surprise, silent upon a peak in Darien. Number 4. In Goya's greatest scenes, we seem to see the people of the world exactly at the moment when they first attain the title of suffering humanity. They writhe upon the page in a veritable rage of adversity, heaped up, groaning with babies and bayonets under cement skies in an abstract landscape of blasted trees, bent statues, bats' wings and beaks, slippery gibbets, cadavers, and carnivorous cocks, and all the other final hollering monsters of the imagination of disaster. They are so bloody real, it is as if they really still existed. And they do. Only the landscape is changed. They still are ranged along the roads, plagued by legionnaires, false windmills, and demented roosters. They are the same people, only further from home, on freeways 50 lanes wide, on a concrete continent, spaced with bland billboards illustrating imbecile illusions of happiness. The scene shows fewer tumbrils, but more maimed citizens in painted cars, and they have strange license plates and engines that devour America. Number 5. The poet's eye, obscenely seeing, sees the surface of the round world with its drunk rooftops and wooden wazoos on clotheslines, and its clay males and females with hot legs and rosebud breasts in rollaway beds, and its trees full of mysteries, and its Sunday parks and speechless statues, and its America with its ghost towns and empty Ellis Islands, and its surrealist landscape of mindless prairies, supermarket suburbs, steam-heated cemeteries, cinerama holy days, and protesting cathedrals, a kiss-proof world of plastic toilet seats, Tampax and taxis, drugstore cowboys and Las Vegas virgins, disowned Indians and cinemad matrons, un-Roman senators and conscientious non-objectors, and all the other fatal, shorn-up fragments of the immigrant's dream come too true and mislaid among the sunbathers. Number 6. In a surrealist year of sandwich men and sunbathers, dead sunflowers and live telephones, housebroken politicos with party whips performed as usual in the rings of their syndrome circuses, where tumblers and human cannonballs fill the air like cries when some cool clown pressed an inedible mushroom button and an inaudible Sunday bomb fell down, catching the president at his prayers on the 19th green. Oh, it was a spring of fir leaves and cobalt flowers, when Cadillacs fell through the trees like rain, drowning the meadows with madness, while out of every imitation cloud dropped myriad wingless crowds of nutless Nagasaki survivors on newly irradiated bicycles, and lost teacups full of our ashes floated by. Number 7. This life is not a circus where the shy performing dogs of love look on as time flicks out its tricky whip to race us through our paces. Yet gay parading floats drift by, decorated with gorgeous gussies in silk tights and attended by moithering monkeys, make-believe monks, horny Hiawathas, and baboons astride tame tigers with ladies inside, while googly horns make merry-go-round music and pantomimic pierrots castrate disaster with strange, sad laughter, and gory gorillas toss tender maidens heavenward, while cakewalkers and carny hustlers, all gassed to the gills, strike playbill poses and stagger after every wheeling thing, while still around the ring lope the misshapen camels of lust, and all us Emmett Kelly clowns always making up imaginary scenes with all our masks for faces, even eat fake last suppers at collapsible tables, and mocking cross ourselves in sawdust crosses, and yet gobble up at last to shrive our circus souls the also imaginary wafers of grace. Number 8. Not like Dante, discovering a commedia upon the slopes of heaven, I would paint a different kind of paradiso, in which the people would be naked, as they always are in scenes like that, because it is supposed to be a painting of their souls. But there would be no anxious angels telling them how heaven is the perfect picture of a monarchy. And there would be no fires burning in the hellish holes below in which I might have stepped, nor any altars in the sky except fountains of the imagination. Number 9. Kafka's castle stands above the world like a last bastille of the mystery of existence. Its blind approaches baffle us. Steep paths plunge nowhere from it. Roads radiate into air like the labyrinth wires of a telephone central through which all calls are infinitely untraceable. Up there it is heavenly weather. Souls dance undressed together, and like loiterers on the fringes of a fair, we ogle the unobtainable, imagined mystery. Yet away around on the far side, like the stage door of a circus tent, is a wide, wide vent in the battlements where even elephants waltz through. Number 10. They were putting up the statue of St. Francis in front of the Church of St. Francis in the city of San Francisco in a little side street just off the avenue where no birds sang. And the sun was coming up on time in its usual fashion and just beginning to shine on the statue of St. Francis, where no birds sang. And a lot of old Italians were standing all around in the little side street just off the avenue, watching the wily workers who were hoisting up the statue with a chain and a crane and other implements. And a lot of young reporters in button-down clothes were taking down the words of one young priest who was propping up the statue with all his arguments, And all the while no bird sang any St. Francis passion, and while the lookers kept looking up at St. Francis, with his arms outstretched to the birds which weren't there, a very tall and very purely naked young virgin, with very long and very straight straw hair, and wearing only a very small bird's nest in a very existential place, kept passing through the crowd all the while, and up and down the steps in front of St. Francis, her eyes downcast all the while, and singing to herself. Number 11. In Golden Gate Park that day, a man and his wife were coming along through the enormous meadow, which was the meadow of the world. He was wearing green suspenders and carrying an old beat-up flute in one hand, while his wife had a bunch of grapes which she kept handing out individually to various squirrels as if each were a little joke. And then the two of them came on through the enormous meadow, which was the meadow of the world. And then, at a very still spot where the trees dreamed and seemed to have been waiting through all time for them, they sat down together on the grass without looking at each other, and ate oranges without looking at each other, and put the peels in a basket which they seemed to have brought for that purpose without looking at each other. And then he took his shirt and his undershirt off, but kept his hat on sideways, and without saying anything fell asleep under it. And his wife just sat there looking at the birds which flew about, calling to each other in the stilly air, as if they were questioning existence or trying to recall something forgotten. But then finally she too lay down flat and just lay there looking up at nothing, yet fingering the old flute which nobody played, and finally looking over at him without any particular expression, except a certain awful look of terrible depression. Number 12. Sometime during eternity, some guys show up, and one of them, who shows up real late, is a kind of carpenter from some square-type place, like Galilee. And he starts wailing and claiming he is Hep, to who made heaven and earth, and that the cat who really laid it on us is his dad. And moreover, he adds, it's all writ down on some scroll-type parchments which some henchmen leave lying around the Dead Sea somewheres a long time ago, and which you won't even find for a couple of thousand years or so, or at least for 1947 of them, to be exact. And even then, nobody really, really believes them, or me, for that matter. You're hot, they tell him, and they cool him. They stretch him on the tree to cool. And everybody after that is always making models of this tree with him hung up and always crooning his name and calling him to come down and sit in on their combo as if he is the king cat who's got to blow. Only he don't come down from his tree. Him just hang there on his tree, looking real petered out and real cool. And also, according to a roundup of late world news from the usual unreliable sources, real dead. 13. See, it was like this when we waltz into this place. A couple of papish cats is doing an Aztec two-step. And I says, Dad, let's cut. But then this dame comes up behind me, see, and says, you and me could really exist. Wow, I says. Only the next day, she has bad teeth and really hates poetry. 14. The widder Fogliani, otherwise known as Belladonna, the Italian lady of American distraction, the widder Fogliani was a merry old soul. She had whiskers on her soul, and her soul was a pussy. But she had a hard coming of it. That time I beat her at her own game, which was painting mustaches on statues in the Borghese Gardens at 3 a.m, and nobody the wiser if ever she gave some stray Cellini a free Christmas goose. 15. What could she say to the fantastic Fooly Bear? And what could she say to Brother? And what could she say to the cat with future feet? And what could she say to Mother? After that time that she lay lush among the lolly flowers on that hot river bank where ferns fell away in the broken air of the breath of her lover, and birds went mad and threw themselves from trees to taste still hot upon the ground the spilled sperm seed. 16. Frightened by the sound of my own voice and by the sound of birds singing on hot wires, in Sunday sleep I see myself slaying sundry sinners and turkeys, loud dogs with sharp dead dugs, and black knights in iron suits with Brooks labels and Yale locks upon the pants. Yes, and with penis erectus for spear, I slay all old ladies, making them young again with a touch of my sweet swaying sword, retrieving them their maidenhoods and heads. Ah, yes, in flattering falsehoods of sleep, we come, we conquer all, but all the while, real standard time ticks on, and new bottle babies with real teeth devour our fantastic fictioned future. 17. Drunk again in twilight regions, where walking memory unpicks its fairest flowers, among shorn legions of torn lives and tattered lovers, and the still innumerable illuminated birds of desire, each blind and mad on his own wire, and in a wander of unwaking we wallow after the shot swallows of yesterday's mistakings, until at last come dropping down from foothills as far away as Uganda, the winged, pregnant plovers of undesiring tomorrows. 18. In woods where many rivers run, among the unbent hills and fields of my childhood, where ricks and haymows mix in memory, although our fields were streets, I see again those myriad mornings rise when every living thing cast its shadow in eternity, and all day long the light like early morning with its sharp shadows shadowing a paradise that I had hardly dreamed of, nor hardly knew to think of this unshaved today with its derisive stooks that rise above dry trees and caw and cry and question every other spring and thing. 19. I have not lain with beauty all my life, telling over to myself its most rife charms. I have not lain with beauty all my life, and lied with it as well, telling over to myself how beauty never dies, but lies apart among the aborigines of art, and far above the battlefields of love. It is above all that, oh yes, it sits upon the choicest of church seats, up there where art directors choose the things for immortality. And they have lain with beauty all their lives, and they have fed on honeydew and drunk the wines of paradise, so that they know exactly how a thing of beauty is a joy forever and forever, and how it never, never quite can fade into a money-losing nothingness. Oh, no, I have not lain on beauty rests like this, afraid to rise at night for fear that I might somehow miss some movement beauty might have made. Yet I have slept with beauty in my own weird way, and I have made a hungry scene or two with beauty in my bed, and so spilled out another poem or two, and so spilled out another poem or two upon the Bosch-like world. 20. The Penny Candy Store beyond the L is where I first fell in love with unreality. Jelly beans glowed in the semi-gloom of that September afternoon. A cat upon the counter moved among the licorice sticks and Tootsie Rolls and Old Boy Gum. Outside, the leaves were falling as they died. A wind had blown away the sun. A girl ran in. Her hair was rainy. Her breasts were breathless in the little room. Outside, the leaves were falling, and they cried, "Too soon, too soon." Number 21. Peacocks walked under the night trees in the lost moonlight. When I went out looking for love that night, a ring dove cooed in a cove. A clush tolled twice, once for the birth and once for the death of love that night.